Coming up next, it's the Dig Deep podcast only edition. It's member supported radio, KAXE, KBXE, that makes this podcast possible. Become a member, support conversations like what you're about to hear between Chuck and Aaron. They're going to take a look at the Kavanaugh hearings. Become a member, $5 a month, KAXE.org. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in.
As the days keep turning into night, and even breathing feels alright. Yes, even breathing.
This is it. It's happening right now. Yeah.
It's
okay.
Podcast. It's okay. Way back.
So I'm curious because you've brought this up before, and you've just talked about it. It's like what. What was wrong? If we're going to talk about like the Kavanaugh hearings, for instance, what do you think went wrong there?
It's that's a really hard question because like the intuitive part of me, so the inner reptile conservative part of me, and you have your inner reptile liberal part of you. So I'm not, it's the like intuitive part says those darn Democrats just tried to sink the whole process and it was all a bait and switch and nobody follows the rules and da, da, da. If I step back, I realize that like this has been a long-term project of essentially chipping away at the way we reach consensus at the federal level. And I think you could back up a little bit to getting rid of the filibuster. So meaning you don't have to have 60 people agree. You only have to have 50 plus one or 50 and the vice president. You go back a little bit further. The idea that, you know, consent of the Senate would not mean, is this person qualified as a judge, but a whole bunch of other things. These are both parties that have done this. So I feel like you could look at this in isolation and become very partisan about it. Or you can look at it as part of like a long-term glacial shift to what I said in the regular segment, which I think is consolidating power in the centralized state and in fewer and fewer players in that as being the answer to having to solve the problems of the last consolidation. So in other words, we can't affirm a judge anymore. So what we got to do is get rid of the filibuster. Now we can't affirm a judge anymore. So what we got to do is have partisan party line votes. You know, and basically we're getting to the point where we can't affirm a judge anymore. We're just going to have the president appoint them and forget this like Senate thing. That's the next step.
Well, yeah, because one of the things that Democrats criticized President Obama for during the Merrick Garland confirmations where he had appointed a liberal but fairly moderate, older liberal judge, kind of known as more of a middle of the road guy. And it was near the end of his second term. There was an election going on and the Republicans made the decision, to say, no, we won't affirm any judge because, the voters need to decide. And this was kind of precedent setting. It wasn't done this way in the past.
The Democrats had done it, but on federal, not on Supreme Court,
not on Supreme
federal
court,
judges.
Not on Supreme Court. And there were evidence of times in the
so
past.
So this is incremental.
It's incremental. Right. And it's one of the things that you were just talking about. But my point is Democrats criticized their own president because he did not use the recess appointment power that other presidents, Eisenhower, I think, had done it, to appoint when the Congress refused to act or couldn't act on a Supreme Court appointment. He could have appointed Garland under that provision, but he didn't. And the Democrats are now saying, looking back at this, saying, God, geez, look at the way this turned out. We should have recess appointed Garland so that, we would have had our judge. And then the Republicans appointing this judge wouldn't have been as bad a deal for our agenda, essentially, is the argument behind this. And it's kind of boiled down to this hard line, you know, the whole point of the Supreme Court is to affirm our party's ideology in the law.
Right.
Which is way different than I think it was intended.
Absolutely different.
Because the law was supposed to be a separate branch of government that was a check and balance, one of the three checks and balances on our whole system. And they were supposed to act. Yes, there could be some ideological, legal differences among the justices, and that could create shifts. And we've seen that over time with the gradual, you know, the acceptance of all people as human beings and with equal rights and things like this. This has kind of developed over time. But now it feels like we have a Supreme Court, and this will probably only become more the case, not less, that will do in legal matters precisely what their party would want them to do. You know, whether the Democrats or the Republicans are in the majority, liberals or conservative justices are in the majority. We now have, and this is one of the things you saw brought up in the Kavanaugh hearings, is we lost, the Republicans got their judge. And yeah, the Democrats could have maybe tried to stop him and maybe they could have been successful. But whatever the point is, we no longer have an independent Supreme Court judiciary system. We have a partisan outcropping of whoever is in power for whatever reasons they're in power. And now that check and balance is perhaps forever tainted. That's the worry, you know?
Well, and I think the next steps here, as you alluded to, is going to be the president using recess appointments to, mm-hmm. to put people on the court. I've also read, and I've read this from people who are left of center, in the next presidential election, when we win, because Trump will never win again, when we take back the presidency, then we're going to increase the Supreme Court to 11 seats.
Oh, that's what Roosevelt tried to do back in the 30s.
Stuff the court, right. Mm-hmm. And so I think I don't know, as you can say, like, individually they've been compromised, because I mean, you can look back at the Obamacare ruling, and Justice Roberts went out of his way to find a way to make Obamacare legal in a way that, like, Republicans hated and I thought was wrong, but I'm not a Supreme Court justice, so he knows more about the law than I do. But I didn't like his opinion. I didn't agree with it, but hey, he's the Supreme Justice. He went along with
the liberals' judges.
Mm-hmm. So there is some independence there. I think the question becomes, are you stacking this with the best justices who also kind of have judicial temperaments aligned with your kind of worldview? Or are you stacking it with people who are essentially like your Princeton drinking club buddies, mm-hmm. frat boys who, you know, are pretty reliable, going to vote the way you want them to vote on key issues? It seems like the more we make this into that kind of contest, the more you're going to get the latter, which is not right. What you want.
Right.
So I agree with you in the extent that I think if nothing else, the I would use the word like competency as more than independence, because I think there still is. Mm-hmm. We're not removing justices when they, I mean, Trump can't remove Kavanaugh if he goes in and votes the way he doesn't want him to.
Right.
Yet.
Not yet.
Right.
And in fact, this could be, this particular president could be a good example of, you know, because well, you mentioned the Roberts decision on Obamacare being kind of a classic example. Roberts was seen as he was the new conservative chief justice of a new era of a more conservative court. And conservatives were looking forward to all of the rulings that he would render on their behalf. And then the first big one, really big one, is this Obamacare one. And he comes out the chute with a targeted, it wasn't like a wholly agreed with the liberal justices, but he came up with a very targeted agreement with the President Obama's policy. And people, you know, as of course, flipped out, you know, this guy. The thing of these lifetime appointments is this has happened before with other presidents, both liberal and conservative. And they can't be removed unless they are impeached for some high crime and corruption offense that, frankly, is just unlikely to ever occur or at least be proven in any sort of
right.
legitimate way. When you have a Kavanaugh or Gorsuch, the last justice that President Trump appointed, if one of them were to ever do the same thing for any given reason, I mean, are we coming up to a point where in our system they're going to start, if they're going to treat justices like political arms of this system, then can they be removed and replaced by a more loyal justice?
Right.
You know, the way that a senator who votes with the other party sometimes is often tossed out by their own party. And that's just going to be a very dangerous thing. I don't know if part of this is the lifetime appointments thing. And you're actually taking a chance on appointing a judge that might live 40 more years. And in fact, that's what you try to do. Get one that's just young enough to be considered competent,
right.
Old enough to be seen as competent, but young enough to perhaps live to into their 90s.
You look at the judges now, the old ones are all on the left.
Yes, and that's exactly what makes Democrats so nervous, is right. that we're literally, I mean, they're joking about it, but they're not joking.
No, you've got 30 years
Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a beloved liberal judge. And she is in advanced age, and they're all praying that she takes care of herself, and they show pictures of her working out so that she, we all get a sense that she might make it, you know? And like, that's, I mean, I really do wish her well, and I hope she does stay healthy and on the court as long as she can. But this is no way to do it. No. I don't think, I don't think, because there were some older conservative justices in recent years that it was kind of the same thing. And then they're in poor health. And then, you know, should they be on the court in the last 18 months of their life while they're dealing with horrible, you know, problems that everyone has to deal with, but that this is a Supreme Court justice, then they're trying to keep control of the court right. during some corporate hearing on some corporate matter. It's crazy that this is how we do it. It might be better to have a fixed term on a long but fixed term on these justices. That might be, then at least you can count on there being new appointments every so many years.
I hear you.
I'm not saying I want
that. No.
That's what happens at the state Supreme Court level.
Yeah, correct. There's an age. Yeah. There's an age, 70, I believe, is the age in the state Supreme Court.
Right.
Because Justice Alan Page had to retire, and he would rather not have, but he did.
It does feel like, and again, for me, this gets back to like the centralization thing. What we've done, the more and more we centralize, the more we ratchet up the states or the stakes in this like one area. So let me dive into a non-controversial issue, abortion. you look and like every justice we've ever appointed has to get up and do this dance about mm-hmm. abortion. Every conservative one, particularly, well, it's settled law. We will certainly look at cases as they come up, but I respect precedent, which is basically like a way of saying, I'll vote to overturn this sucker if you bring the right case to me. But, you know, in absence of that, I won't.
Right.
Okay. Democrats are able to make like a huge, with every increasing Supreme Court case, they're able to make this huge case that like all of your rights as a woman, all of your rights to your body, all of your capacity to go meet with your doctor, that's all threatened. And it hinges on not only the control of the Senate, but it hinges on one particular like nomination.
Swing vote. Every vote is the swing vote.
Yep. Yeah. And conservatives are on the opposite side saying like, you know, we have a chance to make history, to save millions of lives a year, to do all, you know, their whole rhetoric. Like if we can just get this one thing. And I actually had people who were deeply, deeply, deeply conservative saying, President Trump disgusts me. He is the antithesis of who we are and who I am. But I'm going to vote for him for one reason only.
The justices,
he's going to support, he's going to appoint a justice that will overturn mm-hmm. Roe versus Wade. Let's pretend this is like a magic world that tomorrow Roe versus Wade was overturned and like the apocalypse, the liberal apocalypse happened. What would happen at that point? Well, every state would have to have a debate and a conversation about abortion. What do we allow? What do we not allow? What would be proper within our cultural context of our state? Would we have no abortions at all? Would we allow morning after pill? Would we allow third term abortions? Would we have no regulations? And what you would see is that different states would adopt very different standards. Some would be very restrictive, some would not. But if you look at cultures where they've actually gone through this, and I'll point to England as being one that I'm familiar with, what they come up with is decisions that kind of don't make either of the extremes very happy, but tend to kind of moderate between the two in a way that from province to province kind of vacillates a little bit. But, you know, do they completely restrict it? No. Do they allow it at all times in all places, government funded? No. I think that in a lot of these issues, and I know there's people who are foaming at the mouth now going, you know, it's a baby. How could you ever say this? Or it's my body. How could you ever? That's what we've gotten to. I actually think that for most people, this is a deeply difficult issue with a lot of gray area, things that are not certain at all. And those things are best handled at the closest level to the local level that they possibly can be.
One of the things I see that's so frustrating is that Roe versus Wade as a product of a debate over privacy and personal rights. And it's a legal distinction within the legal understanding of the issue. Lawyers will have arguments about whether the right to privacy exists in the Constitution, whether it can be supported or not.
On the left, that's what the debate is. On the right, it's not a privacy issue at all.
Well, I understand that, but that's the debate. That's the precise debate we're at here. You got some in the legal community who view the right to privacy and a universal right to privacy that does not depend on where you live in this United States of America, but that it's sacrosanct and that it should be maintained to a point with the Roe versus Wade decision did. It created a stopping point where you could not pass laws against the right to privacy in medical conditions except up to a certain point. And they'd established a legal definition of what that point is. And that's really what we're debating is a justice won't say it's for or against abortion. A justice doesn't think that way. A justice thinks the really highbrow justices who are, trying to get on the Supreme Court, they're having these, they might have their personal opinions, but they have their legal opinions that really come down to this legal argument about the right to privacy. We don't have that discussion on the streets of America or even in the hearing exactly. We have these discussions really about fundamentally, do women have the right to reproductive freedom? What are the rights of the unborn? These are the debates that we have, okay? And it's two different things. It's two different things because one affects the other, but it's couched in this language, and you pointed it out. Like you know what a conservative judge is going to say to the abortion question because that's what they need to say.
Right.
And liberal justice has to have certain things that they're supposed to say to get confirmed.
Right.
And we know that this happens every time there's a vacancy, and this whole process happens. And I think what we're talking about now, what started this is this most recent hearing, which devolved into kind of a theatrical thing that was very, but there were very real things at the heart of it.
That's the confusing thing, is that there are very real things there.
Whether you're talking about how sexual assault is treated, how people who are victims are treated, whether the transgressions of our youth should be projected into our future. These are all these things that are kind of big issues that people want to talk about. But fundamentally, we're having this debate over whether or not a justice who would fall on the side of not supporting a constitutional right to privacy as it is defined in Roe versus Wade, which is a very specific thing, will be appointed to the Supreme Court and become the fifth justice who supports that legal ideology. And yeah, doesn't mean the law changes right away. It means that the next time, and there will be a next time, there's a case brought and it ascends through the ranks of our judicial system and reaches the Supreme Court, that you have a justice who will rule with a 5-4 majority to support that new case, which will have the effect of at least partially overturning Roe versus Wade.
So here's my question.
So this is what I'm talking about, though. This is the problem. We're trying to have this very nuanced discussion, but it's we're doing it with clubs.
But here's my question, and I'll ask this for both of you. If Roe versus Wade had never passed, and abortion was a state-by-state conversation, and you may not like what Alabama decides to do. You may not like what North Dakota decides to do. You may not like what Minnesota decides to do. But it's a state-by-state conversation. Is the conversation then over the Supreme Court justice less consequential? I think it is. I think it matters a lot less.
I don't know, though, because this is...
And I actually think that's a better... I actually think that's a better world, regardless of what happens with abortion.
I disagree, because if you look at the debates over the Supreme Court prior to Roe versus Wade passing, it's interesting, like the 1960 election between Kennedy and Nixon.
Maybe I shouldn't have brought up Roe versus Wade, because I'm saying Roe versus Wade, all these things that we've by consolidating power in one place, mm-hmm. in one person, in a narrow group of leaders, in two bodies, in a couple Supreme Court justices, what we've done is we've made the stakes of those so high. Mm-hmm. I would argue that all the things that we've talked about today are basically ways to make us pawns to that mm-hmm. thing. we can either like win that somehow, yeah. like conquer that. Like I will have five justices and I will defeat you on this issue. Or if not, I will get two more justices and I will defeat you on this issue. And that's a never, like that will never be over. Like that, mm-hmm. that's just a case for like constant dysfunction. If on this plethora of issues, it wasn't decided in DC, it was decided at state capitals and in city halls. It was messier. It wasn't as satisfying because like I look across the plane and I don't like what they're doing in that state over there. Could we somehow, would that be a better outcome? In other words, could you live in a world where one state was pretty restrictive on abortion and another wasn't? One state allowed medical marijuana and another one didn't. One place had universal health care and another state didn't. Would that be a better culture for us to live in as opposed to the one we do now, where these are like binary decisions for everybody?
Well, we've experienced this with other issues. Gay marriage, for instance, before the Supreme Court ruled on it and it became legal across the country. But
you're like making my, right.
Listen though, because we had that experience where you lived mattered whether or not people perceived they had rights for themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to imagine in an environment, because we have it with certain issues, marijuana. I went to California, people were smoking pot because it's legal. Recreational marijuana is legal there. Canada just legalized it. And so you can fly around. There's certain places where you can do that and certain places where you can't. And you got to be careful where you're bringing your stuff because you might be crossing into a state that has different laws. That's marijuana. That's one thing. We used to have that with alcohol where there were different laws. You know, even locally, we had different laws between counties. And that still exists in certain places. So you can kind of get a sense of where there are different laws in different places. But I think it comes down to fundamentally this federalist argument, whether or not that rights are something that should be granted to every citizen, and that those rights can include things that the population defines, that law prescribes as equal rights, and whether that is reproductive freedom for women, or whether that is gay marriage, or whether that is the First Amendment right to practice your religion as you see fit within the bounds of other people's rights. These are things that's why we have a Supreme Court. Otherwise, you could get rid of the Supreme Court and say, you know what, you only need one court. It's down at the courthouse. And there would be situations where, for various reasons, sometimes political, sometimes cultural, that different places would not allow things that even today that we take as settled law that are rights for everybody. And this is, frankly, how a lot of the worst injustices of America were perpetrated over the years, whether it's slavery or women not being able to vote or being treated as equal property holders in the eyes of the law. I mean, this is things we can't accept.
So what we're getting at here is like the fundamental liberal conservative mm-hmm. divide. Mm-hmm. And I respect what you're saying. I'm gonna state it and then state the corollary to it. What I hear you saying is that the role of government is to protect is to basically enforce and ensure that people have rights. People have rights. The government is there to stand up for those rights and to basically protect people from each other. And that's not how I read either the Constitution or the role of government or what was set up in, you can go back to the Federalist Papers or what we've evolved to do. The government is to, in a sense, protect the courts in specific are very much about protecting the citizens from the government. They're very much about like, here's the limited things that the government can do. And then these are things that you all got to work out. These are things that you all got to like take care of. I think when you, the part of the risk that we run, and I think that this is why we're having this like dysfunctional conversation at the federal level is because we've made everything this kind of like high stakes binary outcome. Mm-hmm. I'll give you another example because you brought up slavery and the right of women to vote and all these things, which, you know, obviously are clearly like huge advancements in liberty and humanity. In France right now, they're having a debate over whether to remove basically what we would call in America, anti-discrimination language from their constitution. It's talking about removing it. So language that protects women from discrimination, protects minorities from discrimination. And the reason they want to do that is not because they think discrimination is great, but they think the language is like essentially redundant. It reduces people in a way. You are French. You're part of France. As a French person, you have these rights. We've identified it separately over here as if you're some separate subspecies of French, but you're not. You're French. And we all, as France, have a commonality. And so by doing that, you've essentially given license to look at people differently. We're not going to do that in France. I feel like what we have done, and I think the paradox of liberal thinking in this country is to take us and say, the federal government is going to kind of centralize all the things that we do, and then treat you all like as different groups in ways that I find completely incoherent. I think if we said, you're all Americans, yes, are people different? Yes. Are people being treated different? Yes. Let's deal with that as like a systematic issue. But the idea that like the Supreme Court is somehow going to decide things that are going to happen in Alabama and Minnesota and California, as if they're all equal, embedded in the same like equal culture, I think is kind of crazy. I think it defies, not only defies who we are as humans, but I think sets us up for a system that we have where we're all basically pawns of a never-ending tension game whose objective is not really to resolve anything, but just to keep us in this constant state of tension so that we can be mobilized for power reasons. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's our political system, and it's messed up, and it's driven by money, and it's driven by power, and that's a problem, and I think we agree about that. And it leads to a lot of unproductive conversations and frankly, unproductive. Like I was watching in the Kavanaugh hearing, which is how this conversation started. I greatly preferred the approach of our Senator Amy Klobuchar, who is a prosecutor and who used prosecutorial strategy in her questions versus the more showboat kind of questions you got from some of her Democratic colleagues. I preferred that because I felt that that was more professional and drove towards the issues more. And I think we need more of that kind of thing in both parties. But I think we are still touching on something that is, if this conversation were as it were in France, as you describe it, about how do we get to a point where we can have total equality and stop this parceling out of minority groups as aggrieved groups that require special treatment, because that is fundamentally what drives the white majority in this country nuts, especially on the conservative side of the spectrum, is the notion that people are treated as more important than other people. If this were, in fact, though, a conversation about spreading those rights to all and making sure that it's defended not in a colorblind kind of way that is real, the problem is we have such a history in this country and such a precedent in this country of people abusing power.
I hear you. I totally agree.
And the fear of the government is also fear that your enemies or that hostile people could take over a government and then and abuse and discriminate against a minority. And that's happened in a lot of specific instances. And in a lot of different parts of the country, it's even more prevalent in different ways. So,
But you have... mm-hmm. Okay. To me, this is the fundamental paradox of left thinking. We have to have the federal government protect our rights. So we're going to vest all this power in a handful of people, the president.
Supreme Court or whatever.
And yeah. Then, oh my gosh, we elected the wrong person. Everybody's rights are threatened. Mm-hmm. As opposed to saying our rights are going to be, managed and equilibrated over many, many institutions, over many, many places. And so, yes, that may mean there's a little bit of aggrievement over here, mm-hmm. but there's benefits over here, and we'll work those out over time. No, we're going to have an all stakes binary, mm-hmm. win or lose kind of thing. We want the right to privacy. And we're going to say, women have the right to privacy with their doctors, and that is a paramount right. And to guarantee that right, we're going to have the federal government have the right to invade everybody's privacy by monitoring all your emails and all your communications and all this, because we got to make sure there's not like terrorists out there who are protesting against women, barring, access to abortion clinics. it's a fundamental paradox that in order to save something, in order to protect something, you have to essentially create the means of its destruction. And that's what I struggle with. We can fundamentally believe in the fact that we have a long history in this country of racial suppression, of mistreatment of minorities, that is a systematic thing, that while we've made progress on it, we have a long ways to go. I think we can agree on that. I think the idea that in order to solve that problem, we need to create a more repressive regime that can push back on that, that, oh, by the way, if the wrong people are elected, could go the exact opposite way, to me is kind of like making us impotent as citizens in a way that I think is counterproductive. Does that make sense?
I follow you. But on the other hand, now, while it was fictional, in To Kill a Mockingbird, they convicted an innocent man. And
that stuff happens.
And that stuff happens
all the time.
And I'm not just saying that it would happen the same way today. There was a different cultural dynamic then and different whatever. But the point is, we cannot forget the real implications of the law. We cannot just have it as a high-minded debate among people who have the privilege of debating it. Because if a woman in a conservative state can't get birth control because of the whim of 51% of her state legislature and governor, that she is being denied something that she should not be denied.
Let me close with this. I think if we look at like To Kill a Mockingbird and say that scenario is a real scenario that has happened, in order to prevent that scenario from happening, we have to create this kind of state that is going to have the power and the authority to come down and supersede and interject. The results of that has been 2.5 million African-American males in jail, in prison. We have higher incarceration rates of African-Americans today than we've ever had. And they continue to go up. And it's a huge, huge problem. And it's not because African-Americans are committing crimes, in a sense. It's because our justice system is really whacked. That's what I'm talking mm-hmm. about. And I think part of this trade-off is an acknowledgement that we will never have a perfect system. But how do we evolve one that is more fair mm-hmm. and more just and gets us to a better place? I don't think it is by consolidating power. I think it is by distributing power and having something that would be a little less, a little more messy, mm-hmm. a little less clean. But as you know, Martin Luther King said, I think the arc of history tends towards justice. I would rather work that out in a society than have fights over Kavanaugh hearings.
Yeah, I agree. And the conversations are better had between us in situations like this, or between people in their local environments. We just talked about that in this series. I think that's a much more productive conversation than everybody screaming at their TVs over what they see in a hearing. I fully agree there. I think to get where you're talking about, I think people who would be most affected, who believe that their rights are fundamentally only being protected by the Supreme Court, I think those folks would need to see some goodwill from those who would govern them in their local communities, and an understanding that certain rights should be held as a national, if you want to make it cultural and not political, that equal access to healthcare for women and equal say over their own bodies is something that we can at least agree is an important right. And yeah, there might be some other rights at stake as well. And that might be part of the political discussion. But right now it feels like it's all or nothing. And as long as it's all or nothing, no one side is going to blink on this.
But what you just said was all or nothing too, you know?
I know. But that's why, because, you know, I know there's a whole other argument. That the rights of the unborn should supersede the individual rights of others because it's a human life. That's the other argument.
Right. And you and I can sit here today and say, like, that's not, I think you'll agree, between those two things, which are kind of fundamental beliefs, it's easy to see how people get locked into one or the other. Mm-hmm. And it's easy to see why, while there is gray area in between, it's not clear cut, mm-hmm. like where that line is, where that line should be. These are things that like reasonable people can disagree on. So how do you, if you say like, it has to be this way and like, we can't budge off of that, which there's a left and a right position there on a whole variety of issues. Is that not just an acknowledgement that there is no gray?
Oh, there's certainly gray. I mean, that's the whole thing is one of the reasons why bans on abortion are so problematic, is because of the situations where, it's not an abortion to end a life, but rather a follow-up procedure after a miscarriage. And there's all kinds of confusing gray areas where people have been caught in these horror stories over the narrow definition of the law, over how they're treated.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to laugh. I love you. I really do. But you are doing, I'm saying this in a loving way. You are doing what I think the classic liberal approach is, which is to say, let me give you this one like heart-wrenching situation.
Oh, but wait a second though, because
I hear you,
because I
like,
know
to
that
kill
that's,
a mockingbird is like a heartbreaking, like that's a horrible story.
Right.
But the incarceration of millions of African Americans.
You say that I'm not, there's no gray. Well, I fully understand that there's gray.
Yeah.
You know, I fully understand that there's gray areas and that one or the other approach might not be the most appropriate. But we have to have a law, and we have to have a law that protects people. The liberal side would say that would protect people equally on the side of privacy and making your own decision between your God and your doctor and making your own decision versus the other argument would say that the law should protect the unborn as though they were full citizens, and that should be the understanding of the law. But fundamentally, if those two totally divergent things can't both be true, there has to be some kind of compromise, some kind of law. And frankly, that's what Roe versus Wade was. And that's why people feel, I think, so upset, because a majority of the country doesn't want Roe versus Wade overturned. A, that's right there. That's a political reality. And B, we have no system in place for protecting rights once it goes down. We have, like you said, every state gets to decide. Will it be political? Yeah. Yeah, every single state will be embroiled in a personal, ugly law discussion that will be that some states will fall on the side of not only allowing Roe versus Wade type laws to continue as the law of the land, but they'll actually maybe fund and provide state support for certain things. And in other places, women won't be able to get birth control and will have unwanted pregnancies that lead to economic destitution because of the will of their legislature. And I don't see that as a productive outcome. I don't.
Do you think, I'm looking at you too, Heidi, do you feel like the three of us who have, I think, probably very different views on abortion, on many issues, do you think the three of us, if we were made like dictator of...
A triumvirate?
The triumvirate of central Minnesota, or even like, let's say, the state of Minnesota, and we could decide like... Do you think that we could come up with something that wouldn't be like broadly acceptable maybe to people, but the three of us could come up with something that the three of us with very different views on this could agree on? I feel like we could. And I guess in the context of a discussion on discourse, which is what this is, mm-hmm. That's what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that our discourse is not helped and our discourse is not made any better. And ultimately the decisions we make are not made any better by having a decision over a contentious issue like abortion made by one Supreme Court justice flipping one way or the other in Washington, D.C., because I think that cascades a whole bunch of crazy things that are even worse than, you know, the instance of the back alley abortion that you know, advocates like to cite as the story. Mm-hmm. In another realm, the idea of To Kill a Mockingbird, of the innocent African-American being railroaded in the local community, we're going to prevent that by having the Supreme Court ensure, you know, this and that at the federal level. And we're just one justice away from, you know, having that reversed. The idea that hasn't led to a system that has systematically oppressed African Americans through our justice system, I think is just ignoring reality. I feel like we could figure that out in a more productive way, in a better way, and in a way that kind of over time evolved our culture and society to a system that was more just, mm-hmm. as opposed to the high stakes being basically pawns
yeah.
of a high stakes discourse at the federal level.
Well, and it's really hard to, like, you put Kavanaugh up there as the avatar of things that everybody loves or hates about everything. And we have these arguments over Kavanaugh, for instance, and whether or not he should be confirmed. When in fact, I mean, what are we trying to unpack here? Forgiveness, whether there should be forgiveness, whether
right.
Whether women are treated well, whether women are believed when they report assault, abortion rights and political issues of the day, corporate influence over everything. You know, all of this stuff is being filtered through this one very specific instance. I don't know, I'm going to meet you on this and say that's not productive.
No.
That's not productive.
Well, and I'm listening to both of these mm-hmm. people talk, you know.
Yeah.
Kavanaugh and Ford, the woman who accused him of assault. And they're talking about, well, I went to the country club and I was over here doing, you know, this hoity-toity thing. And then I went to this little, I remember what I was doing when I was 15. I was working my ass off at a job washing yeah. dishes.
Yeah.
You know, like these people are representing me somewhere. Like I have nothing in common with any of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Why does one justice... And what you're really getting to is one president and their capacity to appoint one justice have such a disproportionate impact on my life. I don't think that I think a system that is that binary, either my person wins and I get what I need or my person loses and it's apocalypse, is A, not reality, and B, to the extent that we make it reality, incredibly unhelpful.
And
for life,
that last
for
statement,
lives.
I know we like to end on agreement.
Yeah.
That last statement, I fully endorse.
High five. There we go.
I don't know that we solved everything, but I certainly agree with you on that. And I think whether it comes from unraveling a central federal approach to things or whether it comes from a groundswell of actual action at the ground level is the question. And I would support people practicing this in their lives, regardless of your politics.
I think that's Dig Deep. That's a podcast only. We would love to hear from you. Weigh in on this. You can email us comments@kaxe.org. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.